Welcome to the first ever episode of Silicon Subcontinent, a podcast where we blend the Indian goat story with the perspectives of Indians abroad and in the motherland.
I'm Shreyansh. I study CS at Rice as a senior, and Aman studies EECS at Berkeley as a senior. And we have our first guest today. Aman, you want to introduce him?
Yeah, so this is a very special episode. It's our first episode, and so we had to bring out the top guns. And today we have with us Nikunj Jain, who was an EECS and EMS major. So for those of you who are not aware, that's electrical engineering and computer science and engineering, math and stats. So that's more majors than I've had cups of water today. He passed out of Berkeley in 2018, where he was a machine learning researcher. And at Berkeley, he also interned at Apple. But then he took a different route and switched to quant at Bridgewater as his full-time job, where he's still working today. And so, Nikunj, welcome to the podcast. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me, guys. It's so nice to be here. How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. Shreyansh?
We're doing awesome. Early in the morning still, so maybe yeah. Need a cup of coffee before I get going.
So, Nikunj, how has working remotely been? You said that you've been working remotely for a while now. And do you see this trend continuing even after sort of the lockdowns have been lifted?
It's a very interesting thing. We just finished a year of working remotely, and, you know, we were all talking about this. And, you know, we're lucky to be in one of the industries where it hasn't hit us that hard. Our work is, you know, it goes on pretty much as normal. We trade online, we research online, it works out just fine. We've all set up these, you know, extensive work from home setups and things like that. So in that sense, work has been fine. It's actually let me have a lot more flexibility in life. I'm currently on a cross-country road trip where I'm living in a new city every month. So I'm currently actually driving to Chicago. And in that sense, it's been great. Now, whether it'll continue, I don't know, because, you know, the downsides of you miss the environment at work, you miss networking with people, you miss socializing, and all said and done, like it's weird to have faces on a screen that, you know, you've never interacted with, and you meet new people, and it's a whole different experience. So I wouldn't want it to continue extensively in this format indefinitely. It would be nice to have this kind of flexibility. It's nice knowing that, hey, you know, 1 month in a year, if I want to go ski somewhere, or if we all want to travel, or I want to go back to India and spend time with family, I no longer have to trade off between just not working and spending time with people I care about. But I wouldn't want to do this 12 months in a year. And I don't think, you know, most people I talk to are saying very similar things.
I see. That's very interesting. So do you think, just to double click on that, do you think companies will become more flexible, maybe if not, you know, work from home permanently or work from home for a majority of the time, but do you think they'll allow for more work from home in general in the future?
I would definitely like that. And I am starting to see that trend. You see a lot of these big tech companies, you know, Google, Microsoft, they're all saying, hey, we won't insist that you come back for at least another year. When you do, it'll be sort of up to you. You set your own working conditions and things like that. Honestly, when you look at, you know, there's multiple ways I look at this. There's like the productivity side, which is earlier we used to think, you know, if you're all at home, no one's going to do anything. You're just going to sleep all day and you're going to miss out on all the work. But what we're seeing in my company and as I talk to friends is it's actually the reverse, right? Because now your boss messages you or you see an interesting article come up and it's like 10 p.m. after dinner and you're like, oh, maybe I should spend 30 minutes looking into what this is. Right. And it's so easy to do because your entire setup is right there. And so companies have actually seen more productivity. So they're pretty happy with it. And I'm definitely seeing that trend, that part of the trend continuing, which is offering that flexibility. And then that being said, like the thing we talked just, you know, a few moments ago of people still want to meet each other. Like there's going to be very few people with very special circumstances who are going to say, no, I just want to stay in my room in, you know, an isolated city somewhere and never meet anyone ever again. So what I see is a more hybrid version going forward. It's going to be some mix of, hey, the office is open if you want to come in. And if you don't, like that's fine too.
Definitely. So with that, let us talk about your life before Berkeley. I know Berkeley was a very pivotal moment. Let's double click on that later, but let's talk about your life before Berkeley. So tell us more about, you know, a little bit about where you grew up, how was school like for you, because you're coming from India, and what made you maybe want to join Berkeley?
So I'm going to tell you a very cliched story here, and it stops being cliched once we get to Berkeley. But, you know, I grew up in Delhi by and large. I mean, I've moved around a little bit, but, you know, all of my high school, middle school is all in Delhi. And I went to a school no one's ever heard of. It's called K.R. Mangalam World School. And, you know, growing up, it was like, well, what are you going to do? I don't know. Okay, fine, go do engineering. That was a very, very standard thing. Well, if you're doing engineering, you kind of have to go to IIT. That's the move. You know, you're a smart kid, you get good grades. All right, fine, let's put you in one of these. Let's put you in Fidji. So I went to Vidya Mandir, and I started early in ninth, which I don't know how much context you have, but it's actually not that early. People start in like fifth, sixth. That's crazy. And so for me, high school, at least on the academic side, was pretty much like, you know, spend 12 hours a day solving IIT exams, you know, prepping for just that entrance. And that had sort of become my whole focus. And it just so happened that in like sometime in 11th, a friend of mine was like, you know, all you can do is study for an exam. Like if you ever had to write more of an application, no one would take you. And I sort of took that as a challenge and decided, you know what, you're right. Like I sort of need to broaden my perspective from just studying into like, let's do more things. And I had very little ideas of like the US education system or how all of this worked. And so I got a counselor very late. And when I was picking colleges, I Googled best colleges for computer science in the world. MIT came up as number one. I applied, I got rejected. It sort of broke my heart. I was like, oh, how can they say no to me? Like, oh my God, you know? And then Stanford was two, and they said no also. And so the heartbreak continues. But then Berkeley was three. Somehow they said yes. And I was like, okay, you know what? Three seems fine. And I sort of showed up here. I still wrote the JE. I still got a pretty decent rank. But that's sort of the story of how I ended up at Berkeley.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. So why did you sort of choose to come to Berkeley versus still going to the IITs? So was there some sort of sunk cost there that you'd spend so much time sort of preparing for the JE, which is obviously not a trivial exam by any means?
That's a very interesting thing that, you know, I wrestled with for a while. I still sometimes look back and say, did I do the right thing? I think most definitely I think I did the right thing in my case. And there's a couple of parts to your question that are very interesting. One is the sunk cost bit. I think it was actually a very formative thing, because what it sort of shaped me to do is it showed me the kind of competition that existed in India. And it said, look, if you know, if you're not at the top of your game, there's like 10 lakh other students, and you're just going to get completely left behind. And that mentality has never left me. That mentality of constantly working hard, of trying to be the best you can be, you know, really, really focusing on what you want. So in that case, it was definitely a cost. It wasn't sunk. I think it was very, very formative to me. Now on the bigger question of like, you know, why I picked one over the other. At that moment in life, I realized sort of preparing and getting into IIT gives you a lot of what that experience is worth. So I've not been, I can't comment on it firsthand, but speaking to friends and stuff, really the big deal of being there is you're surrounded by smart people, and that's about it. And when you compare that to things here, the things you miss out on back home is the infrastructure, the opportunities, the research, the work experience, the flexibility, right? The mentality there is a lot more of, hey, here's a schedule, go follow it. For me, what was more important was, guys, you know, I want to take maybe 5 classes, 6, 7, I don't know. I might want to take things that are completely unrelated to computer science. I might want to do this and that, and I might want to go do research. And back home, those things are just foreign concepts, right? You talk to medical students and they're like, hey, we have all the equipment. We're not allowed to use it. So our practicals consist of going and looking at the equipment and saying, yep, that's the machine. You guys see it. You know, here's how it works. All right, let's go home, right? In case one of you breaks it. That's not the experience I wanted. It's almost lucky because back at that point in time, I didn't know of a lot of these differences. Now looking back and speaking to friends, I'm realizing that, man, coming here made such a huge difference because of these opportunities you get. And then there's a little bit of a mentality thing, which is, I think back home is great for people who are not entirely focused on what they want to do, because it sort of keeps driving that into your mind. Whereas in the US, it's a lot more, let's call it, open to whatever you want to do, right? Now, the problem is if you don't know what you want to do, you can spend many, many years here just going in circles. You know, you'll take a random class in this, a random class in that, and you'll have no clue what you're doing. But for me, it was actually, it gave me this opportunity to say, I want to do computer science, but I also want to explore these other things. And that's something I couldn't do back home. And so I think that that entire combination of, you know, research, of work opportunities, of academic flexibility, non-academic flexibility, like all of these things are sort of a huge, huge advantage here. Now, yep. it sort of comes with its disadvantages, which is you get to see your family twice a year. You get to see people you care about not that often. You lose touch with your entire circle back home and all of that. So, I mean, it's probably different for everyone, but for me, that it's still sort of, everyone I talk to, I'm like, guys, if you were focused on what you want to do, like, please come here, grab the opportunities. They're right here. They're waiting for you.
Yeah, I want to take a moment to pause there and sort of really take in and soak in what you said, because that was a lot to unpack. But something I really liked was the fact that you mentioned India is great for people who are focused, but then you want to go, if you want to explore like your area of focus, it's probably good to come here because you don't find those opportunities in India. That's very critical, because even as we talk about how India needs to sort of mirror the Silicon Valley, maybe that's something India needs to keep in mind, which is in their education system, allow more for more opportunities and more exploration for students, but also still retain that focus and drive that the education system gives you. So I don't think it needs to be a balance, of course. I think somewhere in the US, you'd find that, oh, there's too much exploration. There's this concept of, you know, a lot of people suffer from choice paralysis even, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people come in with so many ideas of, okay, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to do. There's so many things. I don't know what to do. And then they just get lost in that paralysis. But in India, you said, I don't know anything, so I'm just going to do engineering, just trying to go and solve problems, just going to try and build things. So that kind of drive and focus is very important too. That's very insightful.
Yeah, so, for me, you know, that like you're absolutely right. And so I think that a lot of these opportunities can exist in India. We have so many good, talented people and so much, you know, both on the faculty side, on the, you know, it's not like India doesn't have great companies and a great ecosystem and entrepreneurship and so on. It's just that's not the mentality of people there by and large. So it's still a smaller thing. Whereas here, it's sort of like, no, of course, you're going to go do something cool, right? Like, that's the expectation. And I see that shift happening. I see, you know, places like I just found out this place called Pluksha that is opening up in India, and it sounds pretty cool. And, you know, many of these new education opportunities are coming online. So, I mean, let's see. I mean, I'm excited for the next 5 years and how that plays out.
Yeah, I think a big part of why the Indian education system is structured the way it is just that it's still a remnant of, I think, the 50s or the 60s, where some of the IITs were these factories for India to just educate people en masse, right? And then the similar structure was also followed by these other engineering colleges, whether they're government or private. But yeah, like you said, now I think the sort of the ecosystem, the mindset is changing, especially with the growing number of unicorns you see coming out of India now, and the fact that India is pretty much the R&D center of the world at this point. So there's definitely more of a mindset around focusing on exploration, kind of doing what you want, of course, after you've sort of fulfilled some basic requirements for any degree. So yeah, you brought up a good point there.
Yeah, and it's really because I think the thing that needs to change is, for me, a huge difference was in India, if you want to do something new, it's seen almost as like, why would you do this, right? Like, why are you not following the stereotype? Whereas here, if you want to do something new, that is the expectation. And following the stereotype is like, why would you follow the stereotype? You can do so many more things, right? And so moving between one to the other and saying, hey, doing new things is cool and it's good and that's how innovation happens, that's the path we should be on. And I think we are, you know? And so,
That's awesome. No, and we're gonna circle back on that a bit later in the podcast, but this is a good segue into our next sort of question for you, Nikunj, which is, tell us more about your experience at Berkeley. I'm sure you had friends back in India. How does that experience compare to their experience in terms of, you know, some of the things that you did? There are a lot of experiences. For example, you interned at Apple. You majored in EECS and a couple of other majors, so you had a double major as well. But then somewhere you switched between Apple to Quant, and that happened too. So tell us more about that.
I'd love to. So it's a lot of the things we were just talking about, right? So think of it, 18-year-old kid comes to the US first time ever seriously out of India, not on a vacation, right? Like, it's not like a 5-day trip. You're actually not at home now. And you're a little lost and you kind of don't know what to do. And so you start off doing the thing you're comfortable with. But then somewhere along the way, you start taking classes and meeting people that you wouldn't have had a chance to meet back home. So my roommate, he was doing business and he'd, you know, take all these cool entrepreneurship classes and had all these other friends who were doing all sorts of things in the liberal arts and things like that. And so just opening that aperture up sort of allowed me to explore beyond my own comfort zone. I ended up taking, you know, Berkeley was coming up just around then with what is now formally the data science program. I think I took a lot of classes which sort of overlapped with that thing. And the general idea was, look, we can do engineering. Engineering's good. It's cool. Really, the value comes when you apply it to things that are non-traditional now, right? Like, the traditional fields are pretty much fleshed out. You can go into tech. You can go into big engineering companies. But that's pretty much done. The innovation comes once you start pairing it with cool new disciplines. So it's like, let's take all these cool new statistical methods and analyze, you know, the political landscape from left to right. Or let's analyze, you know, the pharmaceutical landscape. So these are both very topical things. We just had the election. Now everyone's debating on the efficacy of the vaccines and things like that. And all of that is examples of the engineering, the analytical mindset, but in fields which you wouldn't think of typically, right? Like, who would have thought you'd have machine learning models predict sort of who's going to win the election on a county by county, vote by vote basis? There's a website, 511.org. And so just those kinds of things are what attracted me. That's what opened up my aperture. And that's sort of the reason for dabbling around and not just sticking into one thing. The whole tech to quantitative finance thing, that's its own interesting story. So like you guys said, I interned at Apple. I spent 3 months there. And the thing that was missing for me was sort of this drive for innovation in the company. It was a lot more of like, hey, we're a big company, you know, everyone's going to keep buying the iPhone. We need to make a small improvement every year and we're good to go, right? And that's a fine mindset when you're a 40, 50-year-old PM, right? Like, that's fine. You show up to work at 9, you go home at 4, you spend time with family, you garden, you make kombucha. I don't know what you do. But it's not, you're not like cutting edge. And that's what was missing for me. I would have loved to go into a startup. I would have loved to do something of that sort. But, you know, with the whole visa situation and immigration and this and that, that was not a realistic path out there. And so I was a little confused, right? And so final semester, I'm not quite sure what I'm doing. I'm like, damn it, I've had a bad experience with one tech company. Maybe they're all like that. Maybe they're not. I don't actually know. And a friend of mine was like, why don't you go into quantitative finance? And I was like, huh? And he's like, no, you know, it's like, it's a hedge fund. You trade, you have algorithmic trading, you do this, you do that. I'm like, what are stocks? What are bonds? Like, what are options? You know, like, those were just things I'd never seen. Like, Robinhood had not come online just around then. And it was just a little foreign to me. So I actually say I learned a lot of things as I was interviewing. Aman was actually around at that time. You know, him and I used to talk. He'd be like, how was your interview? I was like, well, I learned something new this time. I don't know if they did. And sort of I'd go and they'd be like, so how would you device, you know, how do you delta hedge your options trading strategy? And I'm like, there are many words in that sentence. I don't understand any of them. And that's sort of how I broke into it. And it's just this whole mindset of let's just keep trying. Let's just keep learning. This seems cool. This seems like a new, interesting field for me. And the more you think about it, finance, especially hedge funds, so not banking, not consulting, but, you know, quant finance is a lot about just understanding how the world works and people's behaviors and what people are going to do tomorrow and sort of how to look at that through data instead of, you know, gone are the days you had one person sitting in a shop with, oh, Apple's earnings beat. All right, great. We're going to go load up on Apple, right? So like Warren Buffett still does that, but he's about the only person in the world who does that. And everyone else is sort of focused on, let's use all sorts of data. Let's have systematic trading, you know, algorithms and process this in good ways. And that to me was new, interesting, and sort of that's how I broke into this. And a little bit of Wolf of Wall Street helped in sort of painting the glamour and whatnot. But mostly the first thing.
So did you know about the GameStop short squeeze before it actually happened or no?
Well, so first of all, it was all done in 4 days, right? We internally, we'd been talking for a while, so we hadn't picked GameStop, but we were all like, guys, these guys are going to go pick something and it's going to move around like crazy and you don't know in which direction. And that's going to happen for like a week or five, you know, 6-7 days. Because that's sort of the atmosphere that's now been created with this whole easy monetary policy, liquidity everywhere. You're sending checks to people. They don't know what to do. Robinhood's lending you money at 0%. They're saying, go buy stocks with money you don't even have, right? Like, it's fine. Come back in 2 days, 3 days. Who cares? Just use our app. So they're trying to bring all these tech-related mindsets of let's let users do what they want into finance, which is a heavily regulated space for good reason, right? Like, the thing that happened to GameStop, that's what happened in 2008, except on a much bigger scale, right? And that's why it's such a regulated industry and it can no longer happen at that big of a scale. But so I couldn't have told you it's GameStop or it's AMC. I could have told you a bunch of guys are going to post something and you're going to go see that thing either rocket up or down. And it's going to be like that for 3 or 4 days and everyone's going to call you crazy for not getting into it. And then it's just going to come falling back down.
Yeah. No, that's very interesting. It was so weird when it happened. Well, not weird. Actually, I would say that was very interesting. I didn't know a lot about finance then, but ever since that happened, I started to sort of get into it. And now, of course, I feel like that was sort of the moment that so many people today have, you know, all this knowledge of options trading, Robinhood. Every person I talk to can explain payment for order flow. So it's just a lot of things happened during that time. But
I almost joined Citadel, by the way, just in case you were curious. So I might have been on the wrong side of the media here. I got.
Wow.
All right. So, well, Nikunj, you mentioned that. So one thing that crossed your mind was joining a startup right out of college. So what do you think about the startup space in the US right now versus in India?
Oh, I think that's so interesting. Look, first of all, I think, you know, I was talking to a friend yesterday and we were saying, hey, startups in India are now actually at the position of they are solving interesting problems which are real and there's a growing need for them and there's growing financing. And that's what my friend said. And I looked at him and I said, what do you think startups here are doing? And he said, well, they used to be solving real needs. Now they're just trying to capture VC financing, right? And if you think of these things as sort of cyclical flows, the last 10 years, 15 years for US tech, especially, you know, that entire space, it's had so much investment into it. It's had, you know, everyone's focused there. And I have now started to personally think it's an oversubscribed industry. Everyone's starting a startup for any goddamn reason, which like may or may not make sense. And it's just so much money going around that, you know, you could be doing the most absurd of things and people would be like, yeah, that's cool. We'll fund that. Right. And it's gone from 10 years ago where you were solving new things, you're bringing innovation and everyone was doing that to now a small subset of people are still doing that. But by and large, that's sort of starting to fade away here. You look at India and man, I look at sort of the consumer appetite there. I see the growing need of, you know, innovative solutions and smart people to do that. And it's amazing. Like it's something I would love to be a part of. And I think it's 5 years ago, there wasn't money. 10 years ago, there wasn't the innovation. Now we have both. And so now what you will see over the next 5 to 10 years is people capitalizing on these opportunities, people sort of picking up one problem after the other and just absolutely crushing it, you know, creating all these cool new solutions. I'm personally interested in sort of the fintech space, bringing financial literacy to a huge number of people. A close friend of mine from Berkeley is starting something in that space. And sort of you're seeing this across the board, right? So you're seeing this in pharma. I have another friend who's sort of started this, you know, promoting healthy lifestyles for younger people. Like it's all sorts of cool things. And you talk to them and they're like, you know, it's hard. It's not, as always, entrepreneurship is not sort of a cakewalk, but he's like, hey, you know, now we're starting to see the money is out there. We get the funding we need. We get the resources we need. There's a huge talent pool in India that's sort of untapped. Like those people are used to working. And that it goes back to the mindset of you have all these smart kids from all these brand name colleges. They come out, but they're used to working 9-to-5 jobs. And that's been drilled into their head, right? It's like, no, go get a government job. Or no, go get a tech job. And that mentality 10 years ago was very, very fixed. And it's starting to shift a little now. So now you see people taking exciting new risks and saying things like, I'm in my 20s, so what if this fails? Right? And from an entrepreneurship perspective, that's what you need. That's what you need for the industry to start booming. And once you have people saying, so what if I fail? You're gonna start seeing crazy growth. And I think we're getting to that place now, in India.
Yeah, I want to dig deeper into something you said about the consumer, which is, you said that consumers are starting to understand the startup scenes more, or something along the lines of they're starting to become more affable to sort of paying money for startups or for new services. Traditionally, India was always seen as a conservative consumer market because there was not enough risk appetite. People were, you know, more savings oriented. So tell us a bit more about why you think, you know, that mindset is changing, or how you think that that mindset is changing in the consumers as well.
Well, I think that's fascinating. Like you know, you have all sorts of things. Like you have the tea selling app, and you have or even not digging into one thing. Like let's say broadly, what you're starting to see is, one, people are just getting more and more comfortable with this idea of new businesses coming online. The whole thing sort of being in the tech space versus traditionally in India. I remember, you know, back when, let's say, Flipkart started, their big innovation was cash on delivery because no one wanted to use a credit card, right? That's why Amazon never took off in India. And so Flipkart came and said, it's fine, you can pay us cash, just use the website. And that mentality you now start to see all across the board, slowly shifting away from that conservatism of, I don't want to use a credit card online, or online is only frauds, or, you know, things like that, to saying a lot more like, no, guys, let's, like, Paytm's been huge. They're like, let's do digital transactions everywhere. You go to your chai wala, you go to your, you know, kirane ki dukan, and the guy's a little sign with the Paytm barcode. And, you know, I went back home and one of these street side chart vendors who sells, you know, samosas and aloo tikkis for 10 bucks had one of these signs, and I was amazed, and I was like, you know, this is blowing my mind. And he pulls out a used iPhone and he goes, yeah, even I have an iPhone, right? Like that's, and so to me, that was the huge shift. And you're starting to see this, especially in our generation, but also in one generation above, where the people are now more willing to spend more money on services. They're not like, oh, you have to give us everything for free, right? They're like, good service, we'll pay for it. So you, and you're seeing a shift away from more traditional models. You have things like Urban Clap, which, you know, in India, traditionally, you always had the same set of help, right? And they just did everything. But now this whole idea of, no, let's make it task-based, or let's make it service-based. So these are just, I'm giving you small dots in what I see as a broader consumer shift from the times of, you know, our parents and grandparents, where all you did was shop at the neighborhood store, to a lot more of, no, a guy will show up at your door with 10 sets of clothes and you pick the one you like and you send the rest back. right? And to me, that's a very, very, very new, exciting thing.
Yep. And I think in addition to the consumers sort of becoming more open and accepting of new businesses or just paying for services, I feel like Indian startups by themselves have also become, or at least as far as I remember, have always been pretty innovative. Like you mentioned the cash on delivery system, like that's a truly sort of solving a problem for India. And for you mentioned the Alu Tikki Wala having the sort of Paytm plus a QR code or something like that, for example. Like you don't see that in the US. I personally haven't seen too many of those payment systems here. So I feel like in addition to the consumers, it's also the businesses who are sort of getting away from the copycat model where just repeat what's already been done and implementing new solutions. So I think we're definitely on the right track. Yeah.
And it's exciting because I think it's people like, you know, you, me, Shreyans, like we are the kinds of people who have to also start catalyzing this change. Like we have to bring all these views that we see here. Yeah. It's part of, you know, it's part of the exposure. Like for me, the mentality is not what it was one generation ago. One generation ago, it was like, let's emigrate to the US. Let's go join Oracle or, you know, IBM or, you know, there's no Google, Facebook, whatever. But like, let's go join whatever, a big tech company and settle down and build our life there. For me, that's no longer my perspective. I won't speak on your behalf. But for me, it's a lot more of, let's come here. Let's see what the innovation is. And then let's go back and do that home because now I can.
Yeah.
20 years ago, I could not do that back home. The restrictions were too much. The conservatism was too much. Today, I don't see that as the case. I see it as, no, I just need to like get the best education possible, whether in school, whether in industry, whatever it is. And there's enough opportunity and there's enough smart people and there's enough money. And man, that's the thing I want to do.
Yeah. In fact, I see like the reverse happening where there's sort of Indians who are in America or even Indian Americans from America, obviously, are moving back to India to sort of capitalize on the opportunity there. Because so think about it. So there's already a sort of an implicit trade war between China and the US. And so whether that's funds, whether that's countries.
It's explicit, it changes every 2 weeks.
Exactly. Knows? So you never know the situation that's going to happen, right? And the money has to flow somewhere. And so what I think is happening is that a lot of the money that was previously flowing to China is now going to flow into India and some other Southeast Asian countries. But of course, I believe as a patriotic Indian that the majority of that money is going to flow into India and for good reason. I mean, we have the talent, we have sort of, we're on the way to getting the infrastructure that we need to become a truly sort of like manufacturing powerhouse. So yeah, it seems like good days. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I think there's many things to speak to that, but I think a big one is we spoke about the consumer mentality and sort of the startups. The third big piece is sort of the government regulations now starting to fade, which is 20 years ago, the mindset was, you know, if you need to get anything done, there's a million permits. Today, the mindset is, well, there's 100 permits, right? And that's still more than the US. In the US, there's one permit. They're like, you want to go do business? Fine. You know, go do whatever you want. In India, it's still not that liberal. So there's still a lot of roadblocks and there's still a lot of, you know, a lot of the Babu culture, but it's starting to fade. And I think that's the trend you want to get on. That's the trajectory that we must capitalize on, which is the government is starting to see the value in this. Till the 90s, we didn't have a free currency, right? Like there was no open market. It was like everything that comes in, 200% import duty, right? Like the reason in India Mercedes is so highly coveted is not because it's the best car out there. It's just, it was so stupidly expensive because of all these import restrictions from Germany, right? And all of that is starting to shift. So now we're about 30 years into the liberalization of India. That's an entire generation. Yep. Yours and mine, and like our generation has seen a more economically liberal India. We've seen a country where, you know, everything's not as freely available as you see in the US, but it's not like, oh, you have to call up someone flying in to get you imported chocolates or to get you, like, you see a decent car or, you know, things like that. Those days are gone. And in the next 10 years, I see that going away even more. And like you said, the money is now starting to flow in and the government's okay with it. Both of those pieces are important. You've had investors wanting to come into India for like decades. They've been saying the thing you're saying. And the government was like, no, you know what? We're going to put all these stupid laws. We're not going to be affable to the industry. We're going to just make your life difficult. And I'm not saying we're at the best place we can be, but I see the direction going in our favor.
Definitely, definitely. On that note, Nikunj, I want to ask you this. What are the perhaps some of the biggest areas of opportunity that you see in India for enterprises or for, you know, for people like us who want to go in and say, hey, you know what, I want to solve a problem. What are those areas that you identify today or maybe, you know, 5 years from now in India that you know, we can capitalize on?
So I'm going to speak to two of them. One of them I'm very personally biased towards, and the other is just an assessment that I don't know if you should trust or not. Let's start with the second. I think a big space is going to be bringing the, you know, what we call the millennial mindset back home, which is this mindset that we see here of millennials want to seem to live a lot more of a freer life, right? They don't want to be tied down. They don't want to do the thing Americans did or our parents did. So it's most of the world did of, you know, let's get married early. Let's go buy a house. Let's settle down. Let's pick one job. Let's do that for 50 years. It's a totally fine lifestyle, but I wouldn't want to do that. I don't think you guys would want to do that. And our generation is starting to value flexibility a lot more than our parents did, right? So, you know, like I mentioned to you guys, I'm on this cross-country road trip. I talk to my family and they're like, oh my God, why don't you just get a rental in one place for 6 months? Your lease would be so much cheaper. You can negotiate a bit better rate. That's their mindset, right? And for me, it's like, I don't mind paying for this flexibility. Like, so I'll pay 10% extra at each of my housing locations because they're temporary or they're furnished or whatever it is. I don't care. I want the flexibility. It gives me happiness. And you're seeing that in the US. You've seen that over the last 10 years here. I now start to see that a lot more in India, right? Of people are willing to take furniture on rental. They're willing to take houses much more easily on rent. They're willing to take cars in a leasing system. Like bringing all of that and that general flexibility mindset, I think is going to be huge. Now, that's just my own personal opinion. The other one, which I'm most excited about is, guys, we have this huge country that is now coming online with financial literacy, right? This is a country that's always operated on cash. This is a country that all these people just never had access to sophisticated financial education. Why? It was never a priority. You never had the money. And now people are starting to get the money. So I think there's a whole suite of opportunities in fintech, which range from just educating people on how these things work. You see the government doing some of this. You see the government creating billions of bank accounts and, you know, digital payments and so on. But payments are the first step. There's an entire financial system for people to buy into. You can invest in things. You can, you know, go get access to all sorts of things. For instance, I was talking to my family and I was like, guys, so, you know, do you own any Facebook or, you know, one of these tech stocks? I think it was bouncing around a lot. And they said, no, I don't think we're allowed to. Right. And that's just not right. Of course, you're allowed to. Anyway, like, it is a totally free market, but they've never thought about it. It's not something that crosses their mind. And bringing that entire access to a financial system to a country which is now digitally savvy and has the money and has the education, I think is, at least for me personally, where so much opportunity lies.
You know, what's interesting is what the problem that you just mentioned with your family. I have a friend who's working on exactly solving that very same problem. Yeah. And I think he's working on a startup. He got funded by YC. He's sort of going back to India now, but it's exactly the same problem you mentioned. So it's so cool to see, you know, all this innovation happening in fintech. And I definitely think that it's one of the biggest spaces in which innovation is occurring, and it's happening fast. It is happening so, so fast. You see all these startups pop up like Zerodha, and you have Razorpay.
Well, Zerodha is no longer a startup, Shreyans. It's India's largest brokerage now.
That is true. Actually,
60% of all trades. And it started exactly with this mindset. And you're right, right? Like, it's crazy how fast they've grown.
Yeah. And what's crazy is that they have so much more room to grow. Like, they're not even touching the tip of, they've not even covered the tip of the iceberg, right? so many people still don't know about Zerodha, so many people still don't use Zerodha, and still they're the largest brokerage in India. I mean, imagine the kind of volumes and the kind of size we're looking at, especially in a market like India. And then there's Razorpay, for example. I mean, Razorpay is just, it's just doing phenomenally, right? Just getting all those vendors, merchants on board, getting them to use the platform. And they're growing like so fast and at a crazy speed. So it's just very interesting to see all the innovation that's happening.
Yeah, I think a big part of this is also people are shifting from fighting over the pie to making the pie bigger.
Yeah.
Like a huge part of Zerodha's entire story was not, I'm going to steal all my clients from Motilal Oswal or India Infoline or whatever it is. It's like, no, let me bring more people online, right? Like, let's bring this to more people. Let's make the pie bigger. It can be a huge pie. And that's another part of the shift that, you know, we were talking about. And I think that's the way to go, which is finance used to be for like the very, very small subset of people who lived in Delhi and Bombay in all the skyscrapers and had like, you know, all the wealth. And there's no reason for that. There's no reason that it has to be this exclusive elite thing. And Zerodha did it from a trading perspective. And I think there's so much more still to be done.
Definitely. Definitely. So with that, because you mentioned, Zerodha and brokerages. So tell us about your thoughts on a traditional sort of quant, you know, hedge funds in India, right? You've had some experience here now that you've been working at Bridgewater. What are your thoughts on some of the differences that you see in India versus America in terms of the hedge fund that you're working at? Because I think even in India, you won't see a lot of large hedge funds, at least they didn't exist before, but now they're starting to come back. Or with this wave of startups and entrepreneurship, some people are trying to tackle that problem. So tell us what you think about that.
Oh, we can talk for hours on this. I think there's a few things, which is, you know, we talked about regulation in this space. That's been the biggest inhibitor for decades, right? It's not that India doesn't have smart people or they don't understand finance. Like, guys, we came up with most of the trading systems that exist in the world today. We have some of the biggest trading communities that exist in the world today. They had to leave because it was just such a regulated space. That is now starting to fade away. But by now, I mean like over the last year or the last 2 years, right? And that's a trend that is just starting out. What I've seen so far is you have all these hedge funds and they'll outsource their operations to India. And this will not just be engineering or this will not just be like operations. This will be like research. So I have friends in India who work for like D.E. Shaw here. They have a branch in India called Arcesium and, you know, a few others. And so those guys do pretty much the same thing I do here, except they get paid a tenth of what I get paid or a hundredth of what I get paid because they can't actually go trade these things. So what those funds do is they outsource their research much in the way that you think of call centers, but now this is actual quant research analysis, yada, yada. That gets outsourced to India. Those guys come up with all the trading strategies. They just take them here, trade them here, make the money here, right? That's something the government needs to actively work on and deregulate. Now, what is the government's biggest worry here? Man, hedge funds, who knows what these are? Who knows how this works? Fine, it's okay. You don't have to, you know, you can regulate this to do what the US does. In the US, to invest in a hedge fund, you need $1 million. All that's saying is you're not investing your life savings. You have more money other than that. And so the aim is let's target big institutions. Let's target pension funds, sophisticated investors. Not the guy who invests in Robinhood with $20,000 on, you know, YOLO options. That's not the target for hedge funds. And India is moving to something like that. It's not quite there yet, but it's getting close. So, for instance, I've been following, like we talked about Zerodha. They started a hedge fund last year. They, you know, it's called True Beacon. One of the Kamath brothers started it, and they target, you know, rich, what's called high net worth individuals, and that's now allowed to be done in India. So you can start doing similar things. It's still a regulated industry in terms of what you can trade, how you can trade it, the taxation, the reporting. Like, beyond just making it legal, you also have to make it easy.
Definitely.
Right? In the way that, like, the entrepreneurship culture is becoming both legal and easy. On the fintech side, it is still just legal, but it is not easy. And that's the big difference. And so for someone who's not familiar with the space, it's very easy to just completely screw up because you'll come from the US, you'll be like, yep, this is what I do, this is how I do my work. And 6 months later, there's an officer of some sort being like, you broke this tax law, or you broke this compliance law, or, you know, something like that. I'm hoping really strongly to see that shift away. I have a huge interest in quant finance. I don't know of any big US hedge fund with a trading presence in India. No one trades there, right? They all do outsourcing there because labor is cheap and whatever. But there's no money flowing in the space. That's the thing I hope changes, and maybe I change in like the next 5 years. Whether that means you have to raise the money in India, I don't think that's a big deal. I think there's enough wealth out there and people seeking investment opportunities that you can go fundraise in India, and that's fine, right? Gone are the days where you visualize Indians as these broke people and all the wealth was on Wall Street. I don't think that's true anymore, right? But you need the ease of doing that business. Once you do that, I think there's enough talent, and I think the markets have enough opportunities to actually go trade well. But that entire ecosystem needs to naturally grow, and that'll only happen once sort of, like the first step is deregulation. The second step is the government actually promoting that space. Because if you think about it, for a hedge fund to run well, you need a lot of things in the ecosystem. You need people to be educated on how these things work. You need banks, which facilitate trading done more easily. You need the exchanges. So, you know, the Bombay Stock Exchange, the National Stock Exchange, you need these to allow for quick, fast transactions, easy transactions. Gone are the days you see, you know, on Dalal Street, five guys standing with a piece of paper shouting, you know, Reliance, Sorupem, Reliance, Sorupem. Like that's no longer happening. But you need good, efficient systems, right? And so while we're a long ways from high-frequency trading, there's still a lot to go before you can even do traditional quantitative investment strategies in a good way. Now, the other side of this is the data, which also needs to develop. It's another exciting opportunity space for, you know, innovative startups to capture, which is, man, quantitative finance needs a lot of data. And that is always about the local companies. And in India, there's just no culture of reporting. Right? In the US, and to be clear, it's not an insult or anything. In the US, 100 years ago, there was no culture of reporting. 50 years ago, there was no culture of reporting. It started out in the 60s and the 70s, and companies started reporting across a million things. And then in the 90s, people started trading based on those things. And so I think India now first needs to get companies to report on a million statistics, which we can then take and then go trade and price those fairly in the open market. So that was a long rant. I'll pause there. It's just something that's close to my heart, and I've thought about it a lot.
Yeah, so just jumping off of what you said. So when you say reporting, what do you mean? Like, are there other sort of signals besides, you know, the profit in the last quarter, or other signals you use?
If the world's largest hedge fund traded $200 billion on just the profit and the loss, I would be a little surprised. I don't know about you guys. I'm just, you know, I'm putting that out there. No, but jokes aside, I mean, you know, there's a million things on a company's balance sheet that you report. And then you start reporting on innovative data sources. I don't know how much you've heard of. Oh, there's satellite imagery of the cars parked in a Walmart, and let's use that to predict their profit. That's a very cliched one. Another cliched one is credit card transactions and that data to sort of trace the entire chain. But beyond that, there's a lot of, like, let's call it innovative data sets that you can use to predict a lot of these things. Or you can just use very traditional things, but what you need is fidelity in reporting, right? Today, let's take the COVID example at hand. No one seems to believe the numbers that go around anywhere, right? No. People are like, oh, India has X many cases a day. And you're like, I just don't believe it, right? When the US says they have X many cases a day, you're like, okay, yeah, I believe it. I mean, you also believe it because it's high and they're not taking care of it. And that's a separate story. But, you know, you don't call into question the data process, right? You're not like someone's fudging the numbers, or just that people aren't paying enough attention to it. And that's what I mean by good data, which is who's auditing these companies? Who's telling me these numbers are real? What is actually true? I don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty. As that goes away, you'll start to see a lot more things emerge in this ecosystem as the reporting becomes more transparent, as companies become more open. And they're there, to be clear. A lot of the big ones are there. But it's, you know, there's a huge market between the largest 10 and the next 1,000. And that's sort of the space you want to hit.
All right. So if you were to start your own quant hedge fund in India in, say, the next
Do you have 1,000 crores to fund me? Let's go do it now.
which is what I was getting to. So like, what do you think are the major challenges you think you'll face in terms of whether that's hiring good people, raising the funds, which I don't think should be a problem, as what you mentioned. But then what are sort of like the steps or the challenges you see popping up?
I think you raised a few good ones. Like we said, raising funds, I don't think is hard. I don't think it's easy either, right? Like, that's just true across the world. If I go to you and I'm like, come on, give me 5 crores, I'm going to invest it on your behalf. You'll be like, who are you? Main kyun do tumhe paise? Like, it's never an easy thing. Gone are the days when you wouldn't do it. Like 20 years ago, no one would do it at any cost. Now it's just a question of going and raising the money. I don't think that's the hardest thing. We already talked in depth about sort of the legal and ecosystem related challenges. I think those are big, and I think those are meaningful. The other big piece of it that you touched on is the talent, which is in this industry, it's a lot about entrepreneurship. It's a lot about taking risk. I have had fewer encounters with people like that in India than I would like. And so it is a concern I have of, the education system sort of doesn't prep you for that. Way of thinking. It doesn't naturally angle you into it. And so while it might be easy to find talent which follows orders, finding talent which runs money, which is fundamentally an entrepreneurial thing, I'm not sure how easy that is. Now, maybe that's me being whitewashed and sitting here with my privilege and not knowing it. But I would think that would not be an easy thing to solve for. But to balance all these things, these were all the downsides. The upside is there's so much money to be made. Like, those are inefficient markets. Those don't have people trading systematically. You go run something like this there. I mean, we sit here and run it on paper, and we're like, there's a killing to be made. And that's just because it's a new industry. It's emerging. There's a lot of opportunity. And that's sort of the exciting upside to all of these downsides.
Well, on that positive note, let's wrap things up here. Nikunj, thanks once again for taking the time.
Yeah, and thanks for having me, guys. It was great, and I wish you guys luck. I hope this takes off, and I hope I come back on this eventually if you're not too big for me.
If you have your own hedge fund by then, we should be good.
Thank you, Nikunj. Great to have you here.
Take care, guys.
Yay!